Hello and welcome to the Gadget Show podcast. This week, to celebrate Apple's recent 50th birthday, we're taking a deep dive into the biggest flops. And we're also breaking down what the PlayStation price hikes mean for gaming and looking into the latest love story with AI.
Before we dive in, though, a quick thank you to our friends at CEX.
Because if there's ever been a time to think twice before splashing out on new tech, it's probably now.
Exactly. And instead of letting your old gadgets sit there doing nothing, you can trade them in for cash or credit towards something new.
CEX takes all kinds of gear, phones, consoles, laptops, games, smart watches, the lot.
And everything they take has been checked, tested and refurbished, so you know that it's good to go.
Plus, it all comes with a 5-year warranty, which is pretty rare when it comes to refurbished tech.
So if you're thinking about upgrading or you just want to see what your old kit's worth,
head to webuy.com or pop into your local CEX store and take a look. Okay, first up, if you're enjoying the Gadget Show podcast, do us a favour, hit follow, subscribe and leave us a rating. All that good stuff is really important in terms of making sure the podcast gets noticed by more people. All right, Susan, what have you been up to the last couple of weeks since our last recording?
Well, a tiny bit of travelling. So I've been to Brazil and I've been to America.
And like you do.
You know, yeah, exactly. And now I'm back in Wolverhampton, which is twinned with Sao Paulo, apparently.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, two very similar towns.
But actually, I want to talk about Modern Romance and not the band from the 80s, although they were the best years of our lives, looking at this. It used to be pretty straightforward, didn't it? You'd meet somebody through friends or whatever. You'd lock eyes across a bar, maybe bond over a shared love of terrible music at a gig. Job done. Now, though, it seems that it's a much more layered than that. Dating apps, algorithms, the occasional bit of AI to nudge things along. And if you're lucky, an actual real-life meet-cute in a bar or bookshop or something. Not sure about the bookshop thing, but it sounds romantic. And for a lot of people, that whole process just feels utterly exhausting. So instead, I was reading online earlier this week that some are turning to something much more simple, an AI chatbot. I know, my heart actually melted when I read this. Not in a good way. But hear me out. So they can remember your favourite band, reply instantly, and they never ghost you. And it's basically obviously already always available 24/7, unless, of course, the servers go down, which is arguably the most modern form of emotional unavailability imaginable at the moment. According to a recent survey, about a quarter of Gen Z adults say that they've already had a romantic or even sexual interactions with AI. And it's not just Gen Z either. Nearly one in five people overall said exactly the same thing. And even more telling, over half said that talking to AI feels a lot easier than talking to an actual human being. It's easy to laugh this off or say that's ridiculous or people falling in love with robots, that kind of thing, very Black Mirror. But the reality, obviously, is a little bit more nuanced than that, because for many people, it's not really about romance in the traditional sense. It's about an emotional connection. Around a third of Gen Z said that they used AI for companionship or support. And we've talked a little bit about this, obviously, on the podcast before. And even people already in relationships are doing it as well. So the chatbot isn't just flirting, it's listening. It's filling a gap that used to be occupied by friends, partners, or just someone who'd pick up the phone. And to be fair, it is quite good at that. So before we all panic about the end of human connection, it is worth saying that this is just one survey. It's a snapshot, if you like. It's not the full picture. But it does highlight something important. We are living in a world where attention is constantly available. And I'm going to say craved as well, if you look at, you know, social media. And it's even if it's synthetic, when something can offer comfort, validation and companionship on demand, then those lines between affection, convenience and connection, they do start to blur. You get this grey area, don't you? And that's probably what the real story is here. Not that people are falling in love with machines, but that human connection itself is quietly being reshaped, being massaged into something different. What about you, Jace? How do you feel about this? Have you fallen in love with a chat GPT over the last couple of weeks?
It's absolutely fascinating, Susie. It is fascinating. And I tell you, while I haven't fallen in love with ChatGPT this week, I did have an experience in the car, which I think is relevant. I did a long journey, and I noticed for the first time that because of a recent update, I drive a Tesla, I'll just get it out there, and you can all slag me off if you want. Grok has become available as a, you know, touch button touch feature in the car, right?
Yeah.
So I'm able to, so if I press the button on the right-hand side of the steering wheel once, I can ring my mom. I can say, you know, ring mom, and it'll ring my mom. If I hold it down, which I actually did by accident, up comes Grok. And I can chat away to Grok. And it was brilliant. I was really able to spend some decent time in a big, long journey between Cornwall and Humberside, right?
Well, that's a long way.
Hell of a long way, right? Seven plus hours. Just chatting away, talking about business stuff, ideas, you know, blah, blah, blah. Really great. Like, such a fantastic upgrade via AI to the driving experience, right? But I noticed I could move the dial or whatever it is, right or left or whatever, and I was able to ask for different tones of voice or personality from Grok. And I can't remember the word that was on there, but it basically meant saucy Grok. Like, slightly risque Grok was one of the options. And I feel really stupid because I'm sat here. I can't research it. It would be rude. I'm talking to you, our lovely listeners and viewers. So I'm not going to go on the internet. Grok quite blatantly offers a much more kind of emotional, slightly saucy version of a connection. So this is definitely a trend that's going to develop. I would imagine it'll get to the point where, for some people, it will just be like a daily normal interaction. I mean, it poses some enormous philosophical questions for the human condition, doesn't it?
It really does. I mean, what happens, you know, now when someone rings you on your phone, you're a bit surprised. Because you hardly get phone calls now, do you really?
No.
You're like, oh, someone's ringing. Oh, who is it? Oh, am I going to take it? Screen it? Do I know that number? You know, you do this. Are we going to get to the situation where talking to a human being is like that? I guess that's, you know, what people might think when I've just sort of delivered that. So what did you want to talk about, Alexa? Because there's new stuff there, isn't there?
Yeah. Okay. So a few weeks ago, I went to the launch of Alexa Plus, which is Amazon's attempt to humanize their devices, right? So they've always been, you know, pretty good at telling you what the weather's like, or, you know, playing a track off your playlist or whatever. But that conversational AI thing that you've just been talking about was lacking until now. So I was fortunate enough to be given what's called an Echo Show, which is a small screen device. So you can play YouTube videos and all that sort of stuff on it, and you can interact with it using just your voice. But what you get back, I can now say, having lived with it for a couple of weeks, is a much more coherent, much more emotional, more personal version of Alexa. So first of all, it's a lot smarter. You know how old Alexa would just give up the moment you asked anything slightly complicated? Well, that's now been improved on. I've been throwing all sorts of questions at it, random questions, weird hypotheticals, the same sort of stuff I was talking to the car about. And instead of tapping out, it actually gives you a proper answer. Not always, but usually in an intelligible way. Interesting experience I had with it, I've got to say, which I thought was pretty cool, was I decided to test whether I could do a kind of agentic thing. So something where it would have, you know, the agency that they keep telling us AI is heading towards, right? It'll all make sense when I say this. So I said, hey, Alexa, can you order me some dental floss? Because I just thought, what's not very expensive, right? And it said, yeah, here is a few suggestions. And it showed me on the screen a bunch of suggestions. So I chose one of them and then I asked it to order it, and it ordered it. And that was it. And it ordered it using my Amazon account, and it came, like, you know, the next day or the 2 days later. Which I think is really interesting, because, you know, it's a really good example, Suze, of what they've been going on about. Like, what we imagined would be a useful way of interacting with the machine. Well, you know, it's that sort of thing, isn't it? Could you sort out this for me? Could you tell me when the school holidays are?
Moved on, hasn't it?
Yeah, could you put it in my diary? That's sort of where it has access to it. It's starting, Susie, to have a connection to the rest of your digital life via a very familiar interface, because, you know, a lot of people have an Echo. In fact, as I say Echo or Alexa, there'll be people somewhere listening to this podcast and their device will be sparking up because it'll be listening to me. It's rolling out now with what they call early access. So, you know, if you've got an Echo or whatever, then just ask it, you know, notify me when Alexa Plus is available.
Obviously.
And that'll get you in the queue. If you want it right now, the shortcut is obviously to buy one of the newer Echo devices. They're getting priority access to the service. Price-wise, well, okay, it's about 20 quid a month for the service, but if you've got Amazon Prime, it's yet another bolt-on, which I think is really good value. But just watch out, because older Echoes might not support it. So, yeah, but, thoroughly cool technology. I was really impressed. Oh, and Susie, I must just mention, I've fallen in love with a retro video game. Well, it's a modern video game, but with a retro theme, called Retro Rewind. Get this. You run your... It's like a resource management sort of title. You run your own old school video rental shop.
Oh.
So you have to buy VHSs, deal with, you know, late fees and awkward customers. And it's funny, really charming. Yeah, a bunch of overpriced snacks and you know, video nasties, if, you know, should you stock them and all that sort of stuff. Really, really cool.
Like running your own Blockbuster back in the day.
Yeah, completely, 100%. Yeah. It's available on Steam if anyone's interested.
Oh, I love that.
And finally, something else in the gaming world that disappointed me, actually, and a lot of other gamers, and that's that there's been a price hike on the PlayStation 5. So we're talking up to 90 quid more in the UK and $100 more in the US for the same technology. And often it's the case, isn't it, that these things get cheaper over the years. But no, it's unprecedented. We're in the typical life cycle of the console, you know, where you'd expect to be getting offered bargains. The standard PS5 will now set you back £569.99. The digital edition jumps to £519.99. And if you're eyeing up the Pro, which annoyingly I sold my Pro to CEX, interestingly enough, about 6 months ago. Well, if you want to buy one of those new, £789.99. I mean, it's incredible. Even the Portal isn't safe. The PlayStation Portal, that's gone up to £219.99. So Sony says it's down to continued pressures in the global economic landscape. So I'm guessing Ramgate, which is corporate speak for, you know, everything's getting more expensive. I mean, it is. I mean, I sort of feel a bit bad for them because they're operating in such a difficult environment. You know, everything. Utilities are more expensive, which are sort of running a factory, has a massive impact. So, you know, this is interesting, isn't it? Because with Xbox talking about a potential new console, what's the price going to be? I mean, it's...
Well, the geopolitical landscape at the moment is like a roller coaster, isn't it? So who knows?
It's crazy. Yeah. And it's only getting worse.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Crazy time, Suze. Right, time for something very exciting. The brand new Gadget Show competition is live. But time is running out to get involved. We're giving away £5,000 to spend at CEX. And yes, that is as amazing as it sounds.
And this competition is just for our core listeners on Patreon. So the number of entries stays sensible, which means that your chances are actually pretty good.
Yeah, but you need to move quickly. To enter, head to patreon.com/thegadgetshow and sign up to one of our paid tiers. They start at about the price of a cup of coffee. There are three levels, light, mid and max.
Yeah, so light gives you one entry, mid gives you three and max gives you five. So if you want to boost your chances before the clock runs out, then that's the one to go for.
I love it. So once you've signed up, send us a direct message on Patreon with the answer to this question. In what year did The Gadget Show first air on TV? Was it A, 2002, B, 2004, C, 2006 or D, 2007?
And remember, you're not just entering the competition.
Yeah, you'll also get ad-free episodes, early access, bonus content.
And if you're on the max tier, you will unlock the entire Gadget Show archive. Over 20 years of the show, nearly 500 episodes. It's a proper little treasure trove.
Cool. So, extra content, better odds, and the chance to win a £5,000 tech shopping spree. Don't hang about, though. Entries are closing soon. Head to patreon.com/thegadgetshow to get involved.
You'll find the full terms and conditions linked in this episode. Right then, Apple recently celebrated its 50th birthday, so we thought, let's not look at the hits, let's have a look at the misses, because yes, Apple gets it wrong as well, quite spectacularly sometimes. So let's start with the Newton, which hit shelves. You knew we were going to start with that. 1993, yeah. We've talked about this a lot on the podcast, haven't we? And yeah. It's because it was the device where Apple was trying to invent the future. A handheld device that could manage your life, notes, sound familiar with this, notes, contacts, calendar. Is basically the ancestor of the smartphone.
Yeah.
Apple poured hundreds of millions of dollars into it. Wow. And expectations were off the scale. The headline feature was handwriting recognition.
Yeah,
you'd write on the screen with a stylus and it would convert it into text. In theory, it was brilliant. In reality, it was wildly inaccurate.
Yeah.
So simple notes would turn into complete nonsense, and it quickly became a cultural joke, really, famously mocked in The Simpsons and late night TV. Sales were underwhelming, to say the least. Developers lost interest, and internally it became a symbol of Apple losing its direction in the 90s. And when Steve Jobs came back in 1997, he didn't hesitate. He squashed it immediately. But the bigger picture is this. The Newton introduced ideas that did stick. Portable computing, touch yeah. input, personal digital assistance. All of that feeds directly, obviously, into what became the iPhone. So commercially, it was a failure. Conceptually, though, it was so vital.
Yeah, huge. I think I said before, I brought one into to a Saturday morning kids show on the BBC. I think it was going live. I was a researcher. Forget which one it was, but yeah, and I remember having it for like a week and playing with it and wanting that handwriting recognition to work, but it really did not work. It was next to useless, but still kind of cool. I like it. It's got a kind of Matrix kind of 90s kind of look to it.
It did its thing in a different way.
Yeah. No, interesting stuff. Right, next up, the Pippin from 1996, Susie. This one feels almost surreal today. Apple decided to enter the gaming market, partnering with Bandai to create a console. But it wasn't really a console. It wasn't really a computer either. It sort of sat awkwardly in between. Okay, so it launched at $599, which made it significantly more expensive than comparable PlayStations or the N64. And for that price, well, you got very little. The game library was minuscule. Performance wasn't competitive, and developers weren't interested. Fewer than 50,000 units were sold globally, which is catastrophic. And in fact, if you asked a lot of people about the Pippin, they wouldn't even remember it. They wouldn't even know it existed. And that's an Apple product. Public reaction was mostly one of confusion. They didn't understand what it was for, and Apple didn't commit to it long enough to fix any of these problems. The impact, though, was pretty lasting. They essentially walked away from gaming hardware entirely. I mean, imagine if Apple had been a gaming, I mean, they are now through apps, which they sort yeah. of revolutionized, but in terms of gaming hardware, you know, Vision Pro could be the exception, but by no means is it a force in gaming. So fascinating, Susie, that the big Apple tried to get in amongst the fight with Microsoft and, you know, Nintendo, Sony, but they couldn't hack it with the big players, not even slightly.
Next up from the early 2000s, the Power Mac G4 Cube. This is one of those rare products that people love, but they just didn't buy it. It was designed by Johnny Ive. It was a floating cube of glass and aluminium, completely silent, fanless, yes. and genuinely gorgeous, wasn't it? It was beautiful.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It won design awards, ended up in museums, but it still failed. Why, I hear you cry? Well, because it cost $1,799. And for that money, it wasn't powerful enough for professionals. professionals, and it was far too expensive for casual users. So it had practical issues. Reports of hairline cracks in the casing didn't help them. Sales were obviously well below expectations, and Apple suspended production within a year. Financially, it was a massive miss. Strategically, though, it forced Apple to think much harder about who their products are actually for, something that they became much sharper at, obviously, in the years that followed. In fact, they became brilliant at it because they really knew their market.
Interesting forerunner to the Mac Mini, though, Susie, which actually has been really successful.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? That this is a sort of repetitive story where something might bomb, but actually it gives rise to a giant. It does.
And I just brought it up on just Google Images while you were saying, just to remind myself. And it is absolutely beautiful. But the Mac Mini kind of isn't. The Mac Mini is just a kind of, you know, billeted aluminium, big thick piece of toast, right? And yet it's that device that has been hugely successful. And it makes me wonder about Johnny Ive's current project with OpenAI and whether he's still got it, whether that sort of suave industrial design that was so pivotal to Apple in the 90s and early noughties and so associated with the Johnny Ive vision, whether that's going to work, you know, because it didn't work for that one, did it? Okay, how about the iPod Hi-Fi 2006? Now, I had to research this because I'm not that familiar with it. It came out when, obviously, the iPod was dominating. Apple thought, well, let's own the whole living room rather than just your back pocket. So they launched a premium speaker dock at $349. And to be fair, the sound quality was excellent. But everything else was a bit limited. So no wireless streaming like we're used to today, no radio, very few inputs. It was built entirely around the iPod ecosystem at a time when people were starting to expect, well, a little bit more flexibility. Reviews at the time were, I think, lukewarm, to say the least. Sales were slow and it was discontinued after only a year, Susie. I think the lesson here is subtle, Susie, but it's important. And it's that Apple, even Apple, with all their design acumen and brilliant technology and vision, couldn't, you know, capitalize on the success of something that was portable. So it's for the outside world. And at that stage, bring it into the home in a meaningful way.
So we talk about the Apple Lisa. Do you remember that? 1983.
Wow.
I don't remember it. I've got to be honest. I had to look at this one. This is one of the most important failures, though, in Apple's history. Lisa was groundbreaking. It was one of the first personal computers to feature a graphical user interface. Windows, icons, a mouse, all the things that obviously we now take for granted. This was years ahead of most competitors. The problem was it launched at nearly $10,000, which adjusted for today is well over $25,000.
Wow.
That made it completely inaccessible for most people. On top of that, it was relatively slow and the software library was quite limited. So despite being incredibly advanced, it sold really poorly, around 10,000 units, that's all, in total. Public reaction was a mix of fascination and complete disbelief. People could see the future, but they just couldn't afford it. And and internally it actually created tension because a cheaper, more accessible machine was already on the way, the Macintosh. So in fact, the Lisa's failure directly paved the way for the success of the Mac, which took many of the same ideas, made them viable. It's a perfect example, really, of Apple just being too early, being ahead of the game. Technically brilliant, but commercially completely unrealistic.
Beautiful design, though, like something out of, you know, Aliens, you know, like something you'd see on the deck of a space cruiser, you know, really beautiful bit of 80s design. What about this, the Apple Watch edition from 2015? So this, if you think the Lisa was expensive, right, for what you got, how about a solid gold Apple Watch starting at around $10,000? Same internals as the regular Apple Watch, so no upgrade technologically, just vastly more expensive materials. So this was Apple's attempt, you know, to try and get in there, I guess, with the kind of Swiss watch tradition,
sort of luxury market.
Yeah, the luxury jewelry crossover, right? You know, that kind of timelessness that you find in brands like Omega, Breitling, and of course Rolex, and so on and so forth. So within a couple of years, the 10,000 pound device was completely outdated, of course, unlike a classic mechanical watch. No longer supported, no longer current. Apple never released exact sales figures, but it quietly disappeared from the lineup. The industry takeaway was very clear. Tech companies can borrow from luxury, all right? And I think Apple do that better than possibly any brand I can think of. But they can't replicate the permanence, you know, that the luxury market relies on. So, you know, when you buy a designer, you know, jacket or bag, you know, handbag, and it's still, you still pay hundreds of pounds for it, you know, 30 years after it first came out, or thousands of pounds, you know, because of that, because there is a permanence to real luxury, isn't there? Not the case, clearly, with an Apple Watch.
And long may it rain for people that do it properly. Shall we talk about the butterfly keyboard?
So this not familiar with this.
It's not a single product. It's a whole era of MacBooks. Introduced in 2015, the goal was quite simple. Make laptops thinner and sleeker. To do that, Apple redesigned the keyboard mechanism entirely. What they ended up with was a system that was incredibly sensitive. Dust, crumbs, tiny particle bits and pieces all could cause keys to stick and stop working, and the backlash was immense.
God, you know what? That's so interesting. You've given it a title. That thing that we experienced on the Gadget Show with all that travelling.
Yeah, yeah. So customers complained, obviously. Journalists criticised it heavily. I feel like I remember doing that as well. And eventually, there were class action lawsuits. Apple launched a repair programme that reportedly cost hundreds of millions of dollars. And perhaps most importantly, it damaged trust, especially with professional users. So in the end, Apple scrapped the design and returned to a much more traditional keyboard, a rare, very public admission that something hadn't worked.
Hey, how about the Mac Pro trash can? All right, that was another big lesson. Launched in 2013, it was a radical design of the desktop computer. Again, I was a huge fan of this. I think it's a beautiful thing. So imagine a compact cylinder built around a central thermal core. So very functional in its design as well as beautiful. Looked absolutely incredible, but it ignored a key need for its audience. Professional users rely on expandability. I mean, I'm sat here with a computer next to me, which recently had an upgrade. I was able just to, with a couple of screws, you know, not even a screwdriver, just with my fingers, upgrade a piece of the internal architecture, right? This design made that incredibly difficult. So sales slowed almost immediately. Criticism grew, and eventually Apple did something unusual. They admitted that they'd made a mistake. They publicly admitted it. They said they'd designed themselves into a corner. I'd say a lack of corner. The next Mac Pro completely reversed that distinctive design. It was modular, it was upgradable. It was basically back to basics. So a really good example. Another example of Apple learning the hard way.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? They always learn from it and come up with something incredible afterwards. That's what my takeaway from this is. And finally, the Macintosh TV, 1993.
Oh, yes!
So this is one of Apple's strangest products, really. On paper, it sounded like a brilliant idea. Combined a computer and a television into a single device.
Yeah,
a kind of,
logically.
You know, all-in-one media centre, isn't it, really? Years before, that was a normal concept. But the execution was odd. You couldn't actually watch the TV and use the computer at the same time. You had to switch between the modes. It also came in a distinctive black casing, which made it stand out from Apple's usual, obviously, beige machines. But that wasn't enough to save it. It launched at around $2,000 and fewer than 10,000 units were ever sold. It was discontinued just a few months into the sales. And public response was mostly, again, confusion. It wasn't powerful enough to be a serious computer and it wasn't convenient enough to replace a TV. So it kind of didn't tick either box, really. And where it does matter, though, is what it represents. So here I go again. Apple was already experimented with the idea of the living room blending computing and entertainment, but the technology and arguably the use case just weren't ready yet. So you can draw a line from this to later products like Apple TV that you were talking about earlier. But this version of the idea simply came too early and it didn't have, once again, a clear purpose.
Yeah. You know, so when you look across all of these, Susie, what stands out you know, isn't that Apple failed. Everyone fails. Mm. You know, they had big swings, big ambition and big misses, but each one forced a correction. A correction in design, sometimes in pricing, and overall strategy. And that constant adjustment is a big part of why, 50 years in, they're still right at the top.
Yeah, there you go. 50 years of Apple. Right, that's just about it for this week. Another episode of the Gadget Show podcast, Zipped Up.
But before we go, we need to say a big thank you to you lot, the people helping keep this podcast fully charged, our fantastic Patreon subscribers. Huge thanks and maximum appreciation go out to QITB, Logan Gray, Chris Dennett, Gavin Warnock, Stuart White, Paul Burks, Beano Engineer, Gareth Kirk, Colin Wharton, The Gadget Gremlin, Stuart Reinhardt, Matthew Downs, Maxwell Fluckiger, Stephen Bates, Adam White, Havoc, Dan Tainton, Adam Carter, Tom Sanders, Damien Deeks, Chris Derimple, Rick Ellison, you're all legends. Absolutely every single one of you.
There's a few names in there, new ones.
There was.
Yeah.
Let's see what you've got.
A big thank you to Kev Barnes, Yusuf Ali, Ian Wilson, Sam Supersonic, Justin Strong, Wackerman, Barry Music Techno Info, Brian Mark Wild, Barclay Thompson, Stephen Brandon, Zamir, Andrew Brandt, Jared, Fluky D, Paul Sherrick, Mark, well done, Mark, Colin Taylor, Alan Williams, Chris Hughes, and Martin Budnarovsky. Thank you so much, all of you, for your support.
Fluky D sounds like a 1980s sort of New York rapper.
Yeah.
And rounding things off, massive appreciation to Peter Pinner, Dave Green, Ren Mandagorn, Dave McHugh, Matthew Riley, Chris Cool, Stephen Green, Tall Man with Glasses, Andrew Bamford, Duncan Bell, Colin Jones, Gordon Packer, Richard Martin, Simon Ryland, Darren McCracken, Philip Eddington, Andrew White, Skewy Cat, Danny Rushton, Matt Howarth. Honestly, incredible support. We really do appreciate you all.
It's getting like reading out the Gadget Show prizes from back in the day, this, isn't it? If you'd like to join this fine group of Gadget supporters, you'll get bonus episodes, behind-the-scenes bits and ad-free versions of the show. Of course, you'll be entered into the draw for our rather lovely £5,000 CEX prize fund.
Yes, just head to patreon.com/thegadgetshow, sign up and join the club.
See you soon.
See ya.
The Gadget Show podcast with Jason and Susie was presented by Jason Bradbury and Susie Perry off the telly. It was produced by Ewan Keel and Tom Clint and is a North One production.